Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to Masters of Modern. I am your host, Alex Kessler, and I'm back, and I'm here with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's up, guys? Can you believe it? Kessler and I on the same podcast, doing something that's not a top 10 list, talking about stuff like we're both here. There's no stupid jokes. I'm not being Kessler's voice. It's wild stuff.
Now, you are on Skype, which is a whole new thing for us. We've had other people on Skype. Now Ben is on Skype.
It's the first time I'm ever calling into the show on Skype. It's crazy, right? I hope the sound is good. Kessler and I just, you know, couldn't stand to be in the same room as one another, so we just decided to do it this way.
I've been out of town. I was in China. I was in Hong Kong. I was in Dallas. I was in Atlanta. For the month of October, I will have spent in my hometown of Los Angeles a total of 5 days for that entire month. One of those, we recorded two of the episodes for the month, and then the rest, I just wasn't able to kind of be here. And then for this month, I'm back. But now you're going to BlizzCon, so yeah.
Yeah, it's just been a crazy little stretch, man. Yeah, I leave for BlizzCon. I go and record. I actually think I'm doing a press junket for that new Danny Glover Christmas movie tomorrow at 11. You know what I'm talking about? Have you seen the preview, the signs for it? It's like, it's called...
Is Danny Glover and Donald Glover two different people?
Yeah, Donald Glover is the new Han Solo.
And Lando.
Sorry, Lando. Danny Glover is like from Lethal Weapon. He's the guy who's not Mel Gibson.
Oh yes, okay,
right.
I do know who the two of them are. Okay, I know who Donald Glover is, and I know who Danny Glover is. All right.
So I think I do the interviews with him and, like, you know, Gabrielle Union and all these actors at 11. I think I tape Action Movie Anatomy at 12:30, and then I think I'm on the road at 2 to head out to BlizzCon for a talent dinner with all of, like, Malik Forte and, like, Michelle Morrow and all of our talent people doing the TV broadcast. And then I'm just in Anaheim for the next 5 days, like, living in a hotel for the TV broadcast, which is going to be just like, I like esports. I think Hearthstone's awesome. But it's not, you know, it's not my forte. Obviously Magic is my forte. So it's definitely going to be a busy 5 days. I will be taking next Monday off, which I'm excited about.
But not from the podcast.
Well, we'll find time. We'll do it. We'll do it. Yeah.
All
we'll
right. So, on that, on talking about podcast, make sure to follow us on Twitter. We are at the MMcast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. We are at the MMcast. And last week, we added, like, a news segment to the show, and I called out LSV for dropping in the standings of the top 25 because he hadn't done well at the Pro Tour, when, in fact, he just hadn't played at the Pro Tour. I just, like, watched a lot of the Pro Tour, and I assumed, because he was there doing coverage, that it was, like, one of the things in the past where he had, like, played and then
because he does that. He's done that most other years.
Yeah,
when he's not winning.
I just figured, so I just was like, oh, he must have just not done very well and dropped after day one or something.
I think part of it is when they did the change to the pro rewards and the prize pool, part of that, I think, it also came with, you know, you lose some of your appearance fee, or there's some less incentive to play in every pro tour, so it gives them a little bit more of an opening. Maybe they did all of those changes so LSV can do coverage.
Who knows, man? He's really good at coverage. He's, like, definitely really funny. So anyway, long story short, as I called that out on the cast, like, a few people tweeted about it, and just pointing myself out for being mistaken there. I made a mistake. So, but we are on Twitter. I am personally on Twitter, and so are you, as well as Instagram. You can find me all of those places at Ben Bateman Media.
I am at Kess Wiley on all those places. And make sure to check out our YouTube channel, because it's important to subscribe there, because you can watch video versions that Mike Clary does. We released basically last week's episode this week we have, you know, they're sweet. We show the cards so you can know what we're talking about. And last but not least, and this is really important, and this kind of segues right into our news section, which we're going to start doing once a week as well. Collected.company is actually the new home for the Masters of Modern and the Command Zone, our sister podcast.
Yes, we are in a transitional phase to establish exactly where everything is going to end up. But for now, we 100% are there as well. I mean, our YouTube stuff still houses our video, but that is where you can find. And I believe we're porting over all the old archives as well.
So we apologize. So I think some people has run into an issue that either has automatically downloaded all of the episodes onto their phone because it's been updated, so it thinks there's a bunch of new ones, when in reality, We're just moving on to the new site. So we apologize for that. It has been fixed, as far as I know. And then, you know, one of the reasons is, you know, we were originally on RocketJump.com, where, you know, home of Video Game High School and all the other Rocket Jump content. But they're really a production company. They have nothing to do with Magic. And it ended up, we've kind of created this little microcosm there of Magic stuff. And we realized that we probably need, if we're going to start growing and kind of doing exciting things, to have a separate home that is just for, you know, Magic gaming tabletop stuff. And so Collected Company was created. It's collected.company. That's kind of the new, you know, new home for the podcast.
Yep,
exciting
absolutely.
Stuff to come, guys. It's sweet. Next piece of news, I would say, is all the Commander product stuff just came out.
Yeah.
How much did you pay attention to the Commander product, Ben?
Well, I'm part of like a couple of Facebook groups, three different Facebook groups. One, you're in, I think, all of them, and you guys all pay attention to Commander stuff. So I see a lot of posts from Marshall and everybody, and you guys all share cards and 310 Magic and stuff, and like. So I end up like seeing a lot of things like just peripherally, and I read some of them, and there are some really cool cards. I mean, there's that sweet like Gutter Snipe on steroids, the black red guy.
Yeah, yeah.
That card's just like awesome.
Right, and you know he's foil, so you get to play him in Highlander Roulette.
Yeah, yep. Actually, and I was scared there for a minute because it seemed like with the rules changes we were talking about that maybe wasn't going to happen. But now that I'm going to, yeah, I can't wait to play that guy.
Yeah, yeah. For Modern, most of this doesn't, you know, matter a whole ton. Other, you know, there's just some cool mechanical space they're playing in. There's some story stuff that we're kind of learning. I definitely think the non-blue general, which is super aggro, the four-color one, is hinting very heavily that we'll be going to a Viking world in the future.
Okay.
Because she's, like, Viking status and has, like, all of the story around her is very Viking-y themed and, like, barbarian themed. But they do a pretty specific job at making sure not to talk about where she's from. So like most
Got
of the
it.
Other ones, they kind of mention where they're from because that's what's interesting, one of the interesting things about them. But the fact that they're dodgy about it generally is a hint of possible future worlds to go to. And she's so Viking themed behind her on top of that makes it very, very likely, since that's, you know, one of the places everyone always wants to go, that Vikings are on their way.
Like Vikings, so like just define for me for a second, like what are some of the things that sort of go along with like the Viking world that we would see? Like what are some of the common tropes that exist in the Viking world?
Well, so there's the gods, there's like Thor and Odin, and you know, a lot
right,
of them are
right,
in the comic
right.
books, but there's like they're more like they're all war gods. They're like they have themes, but they're always like kind of going to battle, and you know, it's all about dying and going to Valhalla, and you're trying to be with the gods by dying in battle.
Sure.
And you have like the boats with like little dragony heads on them, and you have the horned helmets, which apparently are not at all historically relevant, but you know, neither are black colored ninjas, so we're gonna just move on.
right.
And so, like, you know, there's that kind of world. They're seafarers and they're explorers, but then they're also like wintry, tundra-y kind of people. There's, you know, there's definitely tropes there.
Okay, cool. I mean, I guess I was just thinking because we just had Theros.
Tarkir and Theros, yeah.
Yeah, so there's, I mean, it's
we're
like...
We're going to Egypt world.
Yeah, that's next, right? Some sort of Egypt-y thing?
Well, I think this is maybe a preview for a long down the run. I don't know if this is in the next, you know, year, but I do think...
Got it.
I think this is like one of the first hints of one of the next places we're going to go to in the next 7 years. You know, that's how far they kind of plan ahead.
Interesting.
With Egypt, I mean, Egypt world, I think they don't want to go to... It depends. I'm very interested to see when we go to Amoket, how they handle gods in that space.
Right.
You know, there was a while back where Morrow did a poll on if we were to go to Egypt world, would you expect gods similar or different, or in how different would you like them to be to Theros? And the overwhelming thing was there definitely needs to be gods, but they don't have to be exactly like they were in Theros. So I'm interested how they handle that and if it'll start feeling redundant if we see gods super regularly, or if, you know, how much fatigue do we really have to kind of tolerate that?
Right. Yeah, that is interesting, man. I mean, the concept of a god is very specific, and...
Well, there's so many... Well, Magic does such a job of trying to base, or often, especially with older cultures, trying to base, take those and kind of use them as examples. They did it with Theros to, you know, a certain extent, and it's very, you know, it's something that people kind of latch onto.
Right.
And almost all of those old ancient cultures have this concept of a pantheon of gods, interesting enough. So there's definitely a lot to play there, and I'm interested to see how kind of Wizards... tempers themselves in not doing it too often, but see how they do it when they do it. Because eventually we're going to have to go to Theros too. So there's going to be the old gods that we all know and either love or dislike, or, you know, however you feel about gods.
I just think it's fascinating that how many years that we go in Magic without gods being like a thing.
I think part of that always was Magic had such a huge stigma in the past on...
Right, with the whole, like, with Satanism and, like, all that
shit. Unholy Strength had an upside-down star and pentagram, and then that was taken out, and then they put it back in, and then they no longer did demons, and we did horrors, and that's where horrors came from, and then they're like, yeah, we can probably do demons. I think actually it was Buffy the Vampire Slayer that actually convinced wizards that demons were okay, because that show has heavy... demonic references and didn't have any problems. I think eventually Wizards was like, well, we can do gods now. Like, we couldn't do a god. Like, that was not okay as a creature type. But now that we're doing Greek gods and it's so obviously Greek-inspired world, we can get away with it. And now the seal's broken. So gods are on their way. Egypt gods, Viking gods.
Sweet. Yeah. Well, let's talk just a little bit about what's going on in the Magic tournament world before we start to get into today's real meaty topic. And I would say the two big things, there were some announcements with the Star City circuit. Star City is relevant to us because, well, for a couple of reasons, the biggest of which is that they have a Modern Open every weekend. And they're super sweet. Like, there was the Caleb Durward, I talked about it last week, but that Banned Spirits list was like really cool. And so I expect that to be a deck that's sort of sticks around. We start to see more of. If you guys missed last week's episode and didn't hear about it, he won the event with this really, really cool, like, Noble Hierarch into Spell Quellers and like Collected Company type of spirits list. That it was just very, very cool. Like,
we have
fun deck.
Yeah. And we have a guest lined up in the next couple of weeks that's going to come on and actually help us deck tech that deck. So it'll be really cool.
Sweet.
So Legacy Opens and Legacy Classics. What's new on the Legacy circuit or the Star City Games circuit?
Yeah, well, the biggest changes that they just announced are that they're actually moving away from, they're moving down to only two invitationals a year, but they're doubling the prize support. So it's less opportunities, but, you know, winning more money in those opportunities, which is cool. There's going to only be two Legacy Opens a year, down from three. That was where they were sitting before, and so that's kind of like we've seen this now over the last few years. It's a conversation that happened a lot when Modern was launched, and has happened a lot since the birth of Modern, which is that they aren't going to print duels. So the
Legacy is harder and harder to be popular.
It's just a really, really difficult format to really promote, because at the end of the day, the most ubiquitous thing in the format are these expensive cards that there's a slightly less good version available in a supported format. And
because of that, I mean, that's kind of why they're, you know, on top of that, they're also dropping Legacy as classic options. So, you know, when an open is happening, normally there's classic options at those tournaments. There are no longer going to be Legacy classics.
I mean, if you also consider something for a second, which is that Modern came out in like, what, 2011, 2010, something like that. I think 2011, maybe. I think it's 5 years old, maybe. And if you consider that in the last 5 years, the card pool that is legal in Modern that did not used to be legal, you know, like, Modern has grown by 5 years, as has Legacy, but it means that the percentage of cards that were only legal in Legacy and not legal in Modern has shrunk by almost 25%, because Magic's only been around for 20 some odd years, so five more years worth of cards have been printed now, which every 3 or 4 years as that happens, Legacy becomes narrower and narrower in terms of things you're only able to do in Legacy that you can't do in Modern. So a few cards on the banned list, and then aside from that, there's like probably, I don't know, 30 to 40 heavily played cards that exist in Legacy that aren't legal. And it's, you know, it's pretty unfair stuff that breaks the mana curve that Modern wouldn't really want. But the further we get from Legacy, the easier it is to justify Modern kind of replacing it for a lot of people, I think.
Sure. And you know, back to, you know, that's what Modern exists. It sucks. I mean, I'm a Legacy player for you know, a decade at least. My legacy decks now lose value, and I feel bad for people that, you know, have recently invested in Legacy decks because Legacy will go down. But on one hand, your cards are still blue chip stocks. They're still, you know, they change in price so much slower than in other formats. And on top of that, you're going to, you know, this was something that was kind of on the horizon for a while. Legacy isn't a format that on paper is able to grow because of the bottle cap of, we can't print these cards. And Wizards isn't going to back on the reserve list for a multitude of reasons, and so that's kind of the world we live in.
And also, the most expensive cards in Legacy that are only legal in Legacy are valuable in both Cube and Commander, which is the lands and a few of the like really chase cards. And those are formats in a lot of cases where people that have those formats like to for lack of a better term, pimp out their decks. And that means that you want to have the real cards. You don't want to have a proxy. And, you know, it's going to keep the value of those duels high for a long time. It's going to keep the value of your Force of Wills reasonably high for a long time. Like, it's just, as you said, the prices change very slowly because you're ultimately dealing with collector's items. And when people call Magic a collectible card game, that is the side of it that is truly collectible, is the classic side that they can't reprint.
Right. I think, and part of that is also, this will make Legacy less expensive to play, which means it could actually grow its popularity a little bit in the short run. And as you mentioned, like, you know, there are other formats that kind of encourage playing with these cards, and maybe those will become a little bit more popular, or you'll play a little bit more casual formats. But, you know, if one of those becomes popular, life will become a little easier.
Definitely, definitely. And ultimately, they have something really great in Modern. They're just continuing to develop. So I think that we will continue to see that. Let's move on from the SCG announcements. I think those are the major ones, and talk just a little bit about the face of Standard.
Well, I do want to mention one thing back on the fact that they're going down to two invitationals instead of the more larger amount. I think what we're seeing with both Wizards and Star City Games is that they're reducing the amount of, you know, X support or pro support for these as many events, and condensing it so that the prize support is higher, because in other professional esport situations, the prize support is so much higher in those formats. But I think this is the, like, consolidate and then expand again, because, you know, Wizards has been expanding recently pretty heavily. And so the fact that right now we're getting an expansion, we're getting a condensation, is allowing it to then expand again. So they'll eventually extend these kind of prize support expansions to more tournaments or raise the amount of invitations there'll be. But for now, we're in a situation where they have to condense it so they can raise that prize support, because that's how much money they have currently.
Yeah, I mean, man, like, for anybody who's closely watching esports, and I think a lot of fans of Magic are, it is just insane. Like, there's going to be some stuff announced this weekend that will, like, you know, just there'll be some stuff announced this weekend that will definitely be exciting. I can't say specifically what, but it's just going to be more stuff where it's just like, wow, this is like a really viable game for high level competition and you know, well supported whatnot. Like, it's something that we wish we could see more of in Magic, and we just don't get to. And we always sort of scratch our heads a little bit as to why there isn't more prize support and why Magic hasn't sort of grown at the same rate, but kind of is what it is. That's just where it is right now, and doesn't make it any less of a great game. So,
last but not least, this last weekend, two GPs happened. Both won by Blue White Flash, and it's Standard, so it's not super relevant to us. And it looks like the format's just a two deck format. I mean, I know there are other decks out there and they did okay, but White Blue and Black Green did such strong showings at both tournaments that I don't see the diversity that we're eventually going to be looking for.
Yeah, I mean, Standard is it evolves, and it Standard kind of flows in this really interesting way, because you have new cards every few months, so it's created and it's made, I think, as kind of a puzzle that's supposed to give you that few months of diversity, you know, but it's not supposed to be that complex, because they need it to be interesting, but, like, they don't want to make it so interesting that by printing new cards, they're sort of cheating you of the puzzle, right? That's kind of how Standard works, is, like, you get to try to solve the puzzle with the available assets for those few months. And so it is kind of interesting to see that the Pro Tour happened, and as often happens, the big Pro Tour decks, the ones that made the finals, and, you know, they ended up being sort of metagame choices, and the decks that survived are not actually the finals decks. So none of the Aetherworks Marvel decks that were so popular at the Pro Tour are making it. You don't have control decks on either side, so you don't have, I mean, heavy, heavy spell control decks like the two that you saw in the finals, which
there was a blue-red Fevered Visions deck in second place in one of the in GP Santiago. So I don't know if I completely agree that there's no control, but I do think, like, when of the top eight of both, like, five are Black-Green Delirium and five are Blue-White Flash, and I think it's even more than that, is, like, that's a pretty significant notice of, like, this is the rock-paper-scissors of this format. We definitely have a rock and a paper.
Well, I think, okay, yeah. So you have a few things with Delirium. You know, there's definitely some fun stuff. You have like a heavy kind of grim flare and Traverse and things like that. But in Blue Eye Flash, as you have in the popular vehicles deck as well, you just have Smuggler's Copters everywhere. Like, that card is so good. And that card was called out as being so good when it was first printed. But I mean, if you're going to look at decks that are competitive in Standard, what we really want to do is we want to say, okay, what are the Standard cards that we think long-term have an impact in Modern? I think, first and foremost, the easiest ones to put your finger on are probably Grim the Fastlands. I was going to say the Fastlands probably are the ones that long-term have the most consistent place, just because they're going to be...
Well, I think those are going to be interesting, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later today too. Is Fastlands are, you know, they're a slower adopted card, but once they do, they kind of cement themselves there because the decks don't realize, oh, I need to save life in my burn matchup this week, so I need to throw in one or two extra of these Fastlands, and so it's a little bit, it takes longer for decks to kind of absorb these type of lands.
Right. Yeah, I feel that. And I would say, you know, if you're going to try to look and guess long-term, which cards do you expect it to show up more often? I have a feeling Traverse the Ilvenwald is a card you're going to see long-term in Modern. I think there's a small place for it so far. It hasn't been as big of a player in the format as I expected, but I think it's a versatile tutor that costs one mana, you know?
There's Rug, Bedlam Reveler decks that are running it that are really sweet, and we'll do a deck tech on that too. Another guest that we have lined up wants to do that deck. So there's definitely some decks out there that are already starting to play it, and they'll grow. And I do think, you know, right now there's these there's Jund Delirium decks kind of in Modern. I do think there's a hard argument for Junk because you know Thopter, the Copter is another place that will see kind
Smuggler's
of
Copter,
play.
Yeah,
because it plays so well with Lingering Souls because you can A, discard the Lingering Souls to the discard trigger, but then you can also pilot it with Lingering Souls pretty easily. So like,
yeah, you play it on turn 2, you play Souls on turn 3, and then attack. Like, that's right. Awesome. That's really good.
Yeah, like it does a lot of interesting things, and I do think that's kind of one of the cool places that these, you know, Standard cards, looking at what Standard is doing is a good place to kind of evaluate cards to bring into Modern. So that's kind of it for our new section for today. I do want to hear from you guys how you guys like that we're doing this new section in the beginning of every episode. One of the reasons we're doing it is A, because there's just a bunch of cool stuff that we want to touch on a little bit every episode. And B, you know, we're trying to kind of do something that is a little bit more expansive on what this podcast is possible. Next, so the big subject matter for the day, if you read the title, you saw it, is kind of a step-by-step guide on an analysis on deck building, specifically on the land side. So how to kind of build your mana base.
Yeah, so this is how we're going to do this, because Kessler and I have talked about this one a lot of times. We have different philosophies on mana bases, but he's a little bit more meticulous as far as his counts go. I tend to be a little bit more focused on my spells and my creatures, and I tend to like have a really hard time cutting cards, which is why you'll notice that when I play decks, they very, very often should be playing 24 or 25 lands, but they end up playing 23, and I just like try to justify why that's the right move, which it very often is not, and I end up having to add lands. So I'm going to sort of just try to be the audience member here and give you sort of the devil's advocate approach to everything that Kessler says to really help explain what it means and why it is, because I think his is a little less biased than mine.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, Modern inherently is defined by the Fetch Shock mana base. Like from the very beginning, this is kind of what the format's been about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the traditional sort of like the traditional mana base is like somewhere between 7 and 10 shock or fetch lands, depending on what deck you're playing and how quickly you want to fill your graveyard up. And then something in the realm of like 4 to 6 shocks with like some number of basics and then a couple man lands. And then occasionally if it's like a Gavinny Township deck or something, you know, you do that. But that's kind of where most of the decks land. There's some differences, but it all does really start with the fetches and shocks.
So yeah, and this conversation today is definitely going to be leading more towards just if you're building a deck, like the direction of kind of how to build your lands. There's very specific decks out there like Affinity or what Amulet Bloom was trying to do, where your mana base is going to be very different than what we discussed, just because there's a little bit more of a synergistic path that you're going for, and your lands need to even compete on that plan. So like with Affinity, you have, you know, 8 artifact based man lands, you have 4 straight up artifact lands, you have the 1 land that can tap for any color mana if you have artifacts, like these are all, and then a few basics here and there. But like that's, you know, that's specific to Affinity. No other deck kind of plays that. With Amulet Bloom back in the day, is like, how many bounce lands can I run? How many tutor targets can I have for the four Teleri West am I playing? You know, is there a way for my burn matchup to be like their lands were ended up being actually spells versus anything else. So there's definitely differences out there. But the place, you know, people start are Fetch and Shock. And when it comes down to it, and this is the reason Shocks kind of haven't bounced back from that Return to Ravnica upprinting versus the Fetches, that Fetches are a much more inherently important part of that combination.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's, I said it a second ago, but I mean, what ends up happening is that you don't want to play that many shock lands. Like you don't, there's very, very, very few decks in the format, unless they are decks that don't rely on fetches, that want to play four of any one shock. It's just not what happens. You need to be able to search out your colors you need, and then you kind of fill in the blanks. So it's very often the reason they haven't bounced back financially is, yeah, you're playing two steam vents, not right. Four steam vents, but you're playing four scalding tarns.
Right. And if you're in a two-color deck, you play four. Because at that point, you just want every draw you have. One of the reasons you only play two colors is just the consistency of your mana base. You know, you're losing the card options for having just a consistency factor to it. And in that situation, yes, you play four. But once you get to the three-color decks, which are, for all intents and purposes, most decks in the format, you want to play with, you know, probably you're playing three-color. You have your two main color combinations. So you play, you know, In Junk, for instance, you play two Godless Shrine, which is the black-white land, and two the green-black one, and then you play one of the land that's less important. So, like, when it comes down to it, you're playing around five, maybe going to six if you're a little bit more centered and you can play, you know, you want two of each of the colors. And then for the rest of the thing, you go, you know, you just play 8 to 12 fetch lands, and that kind of balance is based more on how many spell lands and other lands you want to play. But you know, you play, you know, four Verdant Catacombs. Then you go to, you know, maybe a little bit less Arid Mesa and maybe a little bit less, or not Arid Mesa, sorry. What's the black? Marsh Flats. And then you go into, you know, some Temple Gardens and, you know, you break it down to what colors do you need the most. And that often has to do with, are you playing a green-green spell and a black-black spell? So often you're playing Liliana the Veil. So are you playing double green? Are you playing double red? Are you playing double white? What do you need the most?
Yeah, I mean, also, you know, remember that there. So you start with the fetches and the shocks, but there's also the mana base you build. It depends very, very heavily on how quickly do you need to hit your colors? Do you need them to be untapped? How many of your lands need to be untapped? And that is where you end up finding the like, how many man lands can I play question, or like, I've actually seen mana bases get like, and that's where fast lands come into play. I've seen decks start to get a little bit more creative with like playing like one of the tango lands, you know, because they're searchable. And sometimes if you don't need to hit an untapped land all the time, you can just search one up end of turn and it's untapped. Like,
well, and the red-green Titan Shift decks play four because of the mountain subtype. Like, there right. are reasons to play other the next level of fetchable lands. And that's kind of the other half is, you know, when you're looking at how many fetches you should play, the more reasons your deck needs to play these other lands is the less fetches you play. Because, like, Burn plays 12 because they don't care about their life total.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Burn.
Blood Moon isn't that big of a problem for them. They don't need to protect against Blood Moon. And so they're in a situation where they're just like, okay, I'll just play as many fetches as possible, as many shocks as possible, and kill them before me because I'm faster than everyone else.
All right, so if level one is fetches and shocks, what's level two?
I would say level two is likely a combination of the fast lands and the man lands. I think these are the second best two cycles in the format in general when it comes to mana fixing lands. We'll get to spell lands later. Because with man lands, you know, modern is a wonky format, so you want to fight against. We don't have Brainstorm, we don't have Preordain, we don't have these cantrippy ways to fix your mana base normally. And so man lands allow you to go make sure you always are hitting your land drops that you need to be hitting while also having a mana sink and something to do with your mana if you get mana flooded. Plus, they dodge Abrupt Decay. The good ones all dodge Lightning Bolt. So, like, there's a lot of different ways they dodge removal spells in an interesting way. And they're always available if you mana flood yourself.
Yeah, I've read articles, like, Paulo has written articles before about, like, why people should play more lands. Just sort of, like, why wouldn't you? There's so many good lands available now that, like, if in Modern, like, why don't you just build a mana base with 26 instead of 24? Because if you get mana flooded, you at least have something to do with it. And, like, you know, like, you don't want to get mana screwed. Getting mana screwed is like the biggest case of the feel bads in the world.
Right. And once you get to like the spell land side of things, so many of these cards are so strong that it is really important. And then the other half of that is the fast lands. And the fast lands are kind of the antithesis of the fetch shock mana base in the sense that they allow modern to exist on the axis that it is, where it cares mostly about the first three turns of the game, while also not losing you the life that's important because other decks are only caring about the first three turns of the game.
Yeah, would you say that in order then you would rank, in terms of strength and skill, you would go fetches first, you would say shock second, and you would say, which would you put third as most important? You would put
Manlands
third, and then fourth would be fast lands, and then fifth would probably be pain lands in terms of color fixing.
No, what's it called? This is the problem with these lands because they're weird, but I would put future sight lands like right after Manlands or fast lands, and they might be before fast lands.
Future sight lands, meaning the whole cycle, because
just the two important ones.
Got it.
There's the for those who don't know, the red green one and the black green white one. Both have a weird effect. We talked about this in previous episodes. Red green one, Grove of the Burn Willows, taps to give your opponent a life to fix any mana in red green you need. And then
it also taps for wastes. And then green white does not tap for wastes. It only taps for green white. But you can pay one, tap it, and sacrifice it to draw a card. So it's called Horizon Canopy. I agree. Those are the two best. I mean, Graven Cairns is part of the cycle of the filter lands that ended up being, you know, those are playable. They're probably like seventh or something, or like eighth.
Well, I think I would actually say they're next. And there's interesting reasons for that. But part of the reasons I would have them as low as I do, or Graven Cairns I wouldn't put as high as I do, is because Graven Cairns isn't one of the ones that releases play. There are very few decks that need double red and double black. Like, the only common, really, that I can even think of right now, and someone on Twitter might tell me I'm wrong, Kiki Jiki is the only double red card that's really heavily played. That's not in like in decks that are primarily red.
I mean, I used to see people play Sulfur Falls. I used to see people play Cascade Bluffs a lot in the old Twin decks because they would play both Cryptic Command and Kiki Jiki.
A
long time ago.
Right, and I think filter lands in general have a place. I think like the black green one is pretty good in decks that are trying to run both Liliana and something that cost double green, and you know, you see black white ones in black white decks because they're trying to do Liliana and double white. You know, there are so many different places in other parts of the format, especially any deck playing Kiki Jiki. Like, Kiki Jiki is almost makes it so the red blue one is very important for that deck, and that's because just triple red is hard and Cryptic Command is triple blue, so that's where those kind of fit. And you only play one or two at most, and two is really pushing it. But if you have a deck that has multiple spells that on turn two or three or four you want to have different complete sets of double or triple mana, then looking at one of those filter lands is really important.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, inherently the problem with the filter lands is that if you draw
two.
A filter land, if you draw two in the opening hand, you're totally screwed. And then there's also the other thing where it's like they're like the worst land to draw in the one lander when like maybe you've already mulled to six. And then you draw that, and that's your one land, and you're just like, oh god, like I don't even get to play. Like this isn't even like a man land where like I wish things could tap on turn one, but I'll be a turn slower. It's like this can't do anything, and I have to draw another land for this to work.
Right.
And so that's frustrating.
Yeah, and so in our current metaphysical mana base, you know, we're having eight. We're gonna say eight fetches. We're gonna play with five shocks, two, two, and one. And now we're playing probably two to four man lands. Depends on which man land, but you know, I generally recommend three to four. I think anything less than less, unless you really can't handle the tapped land. And on the other hand, I would say either you're playing three to four man lands or you're playing three to four fast lands.
You don't
play both. They don't really go really well together, but you're picking one of those based on what our deck is. And then you play, you know, look at your spells. And the other one is the check lands.
Yes, that's the buddy lands, as they're called sometimes. Those are the ones that if you control a basic of the correct type, one of the two, they come into play untapped.
It doesn't have to be a basic. Just if you control, so one was like if you control a plains or an island.
Sorry.
Yeah.
They were printed originally as the allied cycle was printed originally in one of the M sets, like M10, I think.
Yeah, M10.
And then the enemy cycle was printed in Innistrad.
Correct. These see play generally for very similar reasons that the filter lands, and kind of you're not playing both. You're playing one or the other. And the main reason it sees play, and it's generally in blue decks, is Choke is in the format. And so you want to play some amount of untapped non-island-specific cards. So it gives you kind of a blue-red dual land that isn't requiring you to play an island.
Yeah, there's also a handful of these other ones that you'll see that show up in decks. There's like a slew of them in different decks that people will play to avoid the type of island. So you'll see like in Merfolk decks, you'll see them play Wanderwine Hub, even if they don't play white sometimes. You'll see them play Ouroboros in the Clouds because it's an untapped blue source. That's pretty common. You see that a lot. So I notice you haven't really talked about Painlands. You don't believe in Painlands.
No, I think Painlands are next. I do think Painlands have a specific purpose. They have two. At this point, because we have so many dual lands, the reason they're seeing as much important play as they do is because of the Eldrazi super type or creature type. The Wingding mana is so inherently important to that card, to those cards seeing play. And they'll see play forever because Thought Not Seer is a great card, and it's really hard for that card to not be good. And in those decks, they're tri-lands, which is an insane amount of value off of that. But I do think they're not necessarily as important for other decks. It used to be that blue-red decks would play a few, but even then, that I feel like would probably slow down, especially with the new fast lands that were printed and the new enemy, you know. Like, all these cycles that previously didn't have enemy combinations will see more play. So, like, Storm doesn't need it. Like, I don't see them being as inherently important in the format specifically if the Eldrazi didn't exist. Now, because of the Eldrazi, obviously they're important. Tri-lands are going to always be good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we haven't seen a lot of decks that historically used them. They were, and we see a lot of them now because the Eldrazi, like you said, and as you just mentioned, Storm was the thing. And I guess other than that,
I think Twin played a few, but not like a ton, like one maybe.
I've always been a fan of them personally. I always liked the flexibility. But it's true that I'm sure that the reason that they don't see as much play is that the studies have shown over time that that's not really where you want to be, is paying life every time you need colors.
Yeah, and they'll always be around. I mean, they're a colored source that if your life total, if you're like, the problem with them is the fetch shock half of the mana base. Like, the fact that you are so harmful to your life total already with your mana base as like a base level means that you're going to run into an issue where this is an additional land that's pressuring your life total, and it's not that valuable unless you're really getting value out of the fact that it can tap for colorless.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like in decks that, I guess if you were in a deck that was very like base colored, like you didn't need that much colored mana, or where it was just that your life total like really doesn't matter at all. You never anticipate it mattering at all, which is what Storm was.
Right. Exactly.
That's where you do it. You do it because it's the most convenient untapped blue red land that isn't already being played in your deck. And I guess now, honestly, in Storm, you wonder, like, would the blue red fast land replace that in Storm now, or like would Storm really want to be able to draw an untapped source to play as its fourth land to go off on turn four? Probably it still wants Shivan Reef because drawing a tapped land as your fourth land is devastating for that deck.
Sure, though I don't know if it plays it over the blue red check land.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Cascade Bluffs? Or is Cascade Bluffs the filter?
No, land? Cascade Bluffs the filter land.
Okay. Too many lands and names. How do people keep, like, I have no idea at all what the actual names of any of the lands that have come out with the last year are. I don't know what lands are called from Shadow of Innistrad. I don't know what lands are called from Battle for Zendikar. No idea.
Yeah, those are the ones that I was going to be with you on. All the old ones, I think I could name every Czech land offhand. I think I could name every pain land offhand. Definitely every shock and fetch, obviously. I think all the old fast lands for sure. The new fast lands, no idea.
What's the blue white one? Fast land.
Wait, Seachrome Coast, right? Coast?
You got it. all right, so now we come to the last kind of piece of the manland pile the land kind of choice, and that is really getting into spell lands. And yes, there are other land cycles that you could maybe see play, but none of them are really as consistent as the one we named. Some of the tribal ones see play. You mentioned Wanderine Hub, which is important. And then, you know, there's if you're playing Treefolk or you really want to try land, there's the Wander Murmuring Bosque.
Yeah.
But, you know, so far, and as we mentioned before, you know, of the new fetch lands, the one from Battle for Zendikar, the red-green one is seeing a ton of play because of the fact that Scapeshift cares so much about mountains, but the deck needs red-green mana fixing.
Yeah.
So there are reasons to play kind of some of the other new lands, but they're a little bit more one-off. These lands, the filter lands, the check lands, man lands, fetch lands, fast lands, and shock lands are kind of like the main six, with the Future Sight pair kind of being an important piece of that kind of combination.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree.
So next, and once we get away from color fixing to a certain extent, we get into spell lands. These are, you know, each depends on what your deck is trying to do, and sometimes it's metagame. So sometimes they're a little bit better than a man land, or they take the place of a man land if you don't need the fixing as much, or they even share the space. So, like, the most common of this is Gavinny Township. These are the Innistrad spell lands, which we've talked about before. But Gavinny Township, which you can tap for 4 mana and put a +1/+1 counter on every creature. You have Loot House, which is the red-blue spell land that you can tap to draw a card and discard a card. You know, there are different cards from this cycle that are all, and we've talked about each one, I think, before, about why each one is powerful or not powerful. But when it comes down to it, these are, you know, you want, if you're playing some of these spell lands, this is where you get into how important is it if these colors. And these are ones that I would say, if you're playing a filter land, you can't play these lands very well. If you need a filter land, these lands become significantly harder to play. And
definitely,
if you're playing these lands, then a filter land is probably not going to work, because there's nothing that feels worse than just having Ghost Quarter and a filter land in your hand.
Yeah, absolutely nothing worse at all. I mean, there's, yeah, like just had a complete brain fart. The spell lands you mentioned, we talked about this on our top 100 cards episode, but yeah, Gavinny Township is the one that has seen the most consistent play for sure. Then you have, you used to see Loot House, Desolate Lighthouse played a lot. It's not played anywhere near as much now because Twin's not a deck anymore.
Yeah, Blue-Red is worse, so Loot House is worse. But I mean, yeah, you have Loot House, you have the Black-White one sees some play out of tokens.
Yeah, that black-white one, honestly, that's, it's funny because they each one of them, when they're good, they're like really, really good. You know, and somebody plays them against you, and that Vault of the Archangel is like, that's the black-white one.
Yeah.
That's a card that when that gets activated against you in some situations, you feel like you can't win the game. It actually, like, it's one of the few cards that I can think of where somebody's activated that card, and I've been like, oh my god, like, my strategy of, like, playing tempo or trying to burn you out or anything is, like, it's just over now. Like,
you can
block anything I'm attacking you with, like, you can effectively get out of range, like, I have no chance.
Right, and even with that card, like, the fact that some of these cards also have this, like, vague surprise factor, because it's like, oh, I can, you're just attacking me, I can take that Tarmogoyf, and you're like, oh, you have Kessig Wolf Run. Okay, it's now a 9/8 as trample.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah, Wolf Run's really good too.
Yeah, there's each one is kind of has some of the unique. There's obviously bad ones. The blue black one, the red black one, green black one are all kind of bad. And some of these have been huge tournament players. Like, even the red white one saw a ton of play in Amulet Bloom, and so
And the blue white one in Standard was a big player, but then never has really transitioned into Modern. I always liked the blue white one. I always felt like that card was a little bit underutilized. That's the Moorland Haunt, I think it's called.
I think the part of that is just Modern doesn't have many creature blue white decks.
right.
There are some mid-range ones, and I think there's maybe an argument to play those in those. And on top of that, blue decks are generally going to want to have access to either, you know, all the mana they need, so they need filter lands, or they're going to go after kind of a more Loot House, they're playing red kind of situation.
Yeah, did Moorland Haunt make it into Caleb's list at Star City? That's one thing I actually didn't check, and I wonder if it did. I wonder if that played a lot of the same technology as the old Standard decks that played it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen the list recently.
Interesting. Well, when we do the deck tech, we can talk about that.
Yeah. The next kind of step on this is land destruction. This is the other major, I would say, after the spell lands, land destruction lands. So the Inheritors to the Wasteland Fortune
right,
are kind of the most played spell lands. And the big two, and really it's the big one recently people have realized, are Ghost Quarter and Tectonic Edge. Ghost Quarter is probably the most played.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say, and I have found the more and more that I've played in multiple formats that I like Ghost Quarter more than Tech Edge. Tech Edge used to be a much bigger player, and it's funny because Ghost Quarter existed. Ghost Quarter existed back in those days when Tech Edge was the preferred card. It just, for whatever reason, just like over time, it feels like people only play Ghost Quarter anymore. I feel like you almost never see Tech Edge.
I think the main reason is that the format doesn't matter after turn four, and being able to kill Ink Moth Nexus out of Infect and Affinity and/or Ink Moth Nexus out of Affinity on turn three and two is inherently more important than be able to just kill the land forever. Like, I'd rather kill one of those and then have them get a basic land than not.
Agreed. Also, the one other thing that Ghost Quarter has always had the ability to do for decks, especially with the idea of efficiency, is that you can tap a land for mana, then Ghost Quarter the tapped land, bring in an untapped basic, tap that for mana, and essentially fix a color problem that turn.
Right.
Which is something that Tech Edge is not able to do. So
there are other decks where it's kind of been a combo engine. If you look at what it used to do in Eggs, it used to target the indestructible artifact land, letting you keep the artifact land, fix your color, get a blue land, but then when you played Second Sunrise, it would return all the Ghost Quarters you sacrificed back into play, letting you kind of repeat the loop and make your mana base kind of just better and better in play. That deck was sweet. Yeah, so it has a lot of versatility and cool little unique plays. I actually recently just had it with Gitrog out, and I used it on my own land and drew three cards. It was a pretty great.
oh, get round.
the last kind of area after land destruction I do want to talk about, and these are more, I would say, the synergistic land cards. And this is where I was kind of talking about in the beginning, where we weren't going to hit on too heavily. This is stuff like Cavern of Souls or Mutavault or...
Sure, we'll call them like sort of like one-off utility lands or something like that.
Yeah, they're synergy. They're more lands that you play because they're good with what everything your deck is doing versus helping your deck kind of do its game plan with generic winningness. Like, they require your deck to play them. They require your deck to be on a certain game plan. Like, any green white deck can play Gavinning Township. Not every green white deck can play the temple. What's the tap mana to make a bunch of mana?
Tap mana. Oh, Nykthos.
Yeah, Nykthos.
Yeah, and then there's also, like, you're forgetting to talk about, like, City of Brass, Mana Confluence, Gemstone Mine, five-color lands that are just very deck-specific.
Well, I was going to save the five-color lands for the last category. You're jumping ahead.
God.
We're currently in the, like, cheats. We're currently more talking of on, like, the Tron lands. And,
got it. Okay, you know, synergy lands. That makes
synergy
sense.
Lands, like Mutavault and Caverns, where your deck is requiring your deck to do something. Temple... Eldrazi Temple. These are
Glimmer Void.
Yeah, these are decks that will only show up in the decks they belong to. I would even argue like Ink Moth Nexus and Blink Moth Nexus kind of fall into the same kind of category.
Yeah,
where,
totally. Yeah. They're specifically good in their decks. It's not like you're going to play an Ink Moth Nexus in any deck. It has to be a very specific deck for it.
Right. Though I do think they are the most hugging between man lands and this kind of category because they are technically mana lands, as is Mutavault.
Right.
But it's not like they're mana-fixing man lands, so there is a little bit more of a cost to put them in the deck. And they require your deck to be a little bit more on game plan.
Right.
Versus, like, every deck that's playing red-green that can afford having a tapped land come into play regularly is probably better off with Raging Ravine.
Yeah,
that's fair. Just in general. So these are slightly different in that sense, but these are really inherent on the deck you're playing, and these are ones that you'll kind of know just by more... experience with the format or looking online or, you know, just an understanding of these cards existing because, you know, oh, I'm playing a deck that is all green mana symbols, so Nykthos is probably really good. Oh, I'm playing a deck that has a ton of artifacts and I need multiple mana. I can play what's the land that taps for gold in artifacts that I'm forgetting that you mentioned?
Glimmer Void.
Yes, Glimmer Void. So that's kind of where I would put these. And then...
Kessler, can't remember the names of cards ever.
Yeah, whatever, Seachrome Coast. and last but not least, the gold lands. So these are all the colors that you were talking about a hot second ago. This includes Gemstone Cavern, a little bit Glimmer Void.
Gemstone Mine.
Mana Confluence.
City of Brass.
And then the wackier ones are like the one that creates 1/1 spirits, colorless spirits.
Yeah. Yeah, Forbidden Orchard, and then there's like the one-off ones like Tendo Ice Bridge, now Aether Hub, one-time use lands that you have the ability to use once. Mirrodin's Core is one that I don't think sees any play, but is, you know, a modern playable five-color land.
Interesting fact, Tendo Icebridge is better in modern unless you have other ways to generate energy, it looks like, because you still get the counter even with Blood Moon in play.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I wondered... there's not a whole lot of those five color lands. There's a few of them. So here's what's really interesting. The first question I would have is, Modern is a format that we are talking about is defined by its first three turns, right? Which means that a lot of the games go quickly, and you would think that when we talked about like the pain lands not seeing as much play, I'm sort of confused and curious why we haven't seen more play out of Mana Confluence and City of Brass. Gemstone Mine has seen a lot of play in Modern, but City of Brass and Mana Confluence are fringe players, and you would think there would be more decks taking advantage of the fact that those are five-color untapped lands. Like,
it's the same reason as the Pain Lands. It's the fact that Burn exists.
Yeah, there's other things you can do.
It's just like most decks, inherently because of mana fetches, are really playing at a 15 life total.
Yeah.
And so unless you're really careful in slowing your game plan down, so these Pain Lands and especially City of Brass... on Friends, who has no outclaws. Like, at least with Painlands, you can tap them for a colorless. So after, the first three turns, when you really need them for fixing, they become just colorless lands because you have all the basics you'll need to play with them. I guess we didn't talk about basics. We'll get to that in a second. The Mana Confluence-like cards have that inherent problem. They don't... they cost you life. And life is really important in this format when you have Merfolk bashing from left field, you have Burn bashing from right field, and you just need to be able to stay over that life total threshold.
Right. And then you have banned lands like Iavugan.
Yeah. And then basics. the one thing I do want to say about basics is that it's really important that you have at least one basic of every color in your deck, and I would recommend two of every color, though you can cut down on mountains.
Right.
Because of Blood Moon, that's where the mountain clause is. So, it's kind of, you have two of each, but then you can't not play with mountains because of what we talked, Ghost Quarter and then Path to Exile. Both of those cards make it so you are really encouraged to make sure you're playing with, four to five basic lands, and maybe even more. If you can get away with more, that's great. And that just really comes down to, there are at least three cards that punish you for not having them, and those three cards are all some of the most played cards in the format.
Yeah, I mean, also, keep in mind, Modern is a format that is dependent heavily on sideboarding into your very, very narrow sideboard plan, and then sometimes keeping really, really weak hands that have your one card. And the most notorious two cards in Modern's history for that are Stony Silence and Blood Moon. So if you're talking about Blood Moon, and Blood Moon is still legal, and somebody keeps a poor hand against you and they Blood Moon you on turn three, and you don't have the higher, the difference between two basics in a deck and four basics is... a massive percentage difference with the game stalls out where they've played their Blood Moon and they don't have any action, but they're just sitting on it. You need to be able to draw those basics. That's what's going to have to happen. You're going to have to sit there. Imagine you're playing at a high level, like day two of a Grand Prix, and someone does that to you and you're not prepared. You have to be able to draw those basics. That's the most important reason you're playing.
Well, and the other side is fetching for those basics. The fact that, A, you need choices, because there is going to be a time where you drew your swamp and you're going to need to fetch for... or you played your swamp already and you're at two life and you need to fetch for a land and play a spell this turn and then you'll be fine, but if you can't fetch for a basic, you lose.
Right.
And it has to be a swamp. There are definitely times in the game where your fetch lands being able to fetch for these basics is also really important. So you need basics, period. And then the more basics you have, as you said, being able to draw on your basics is really important. And in general, just having basics is always going to be very valuable. Wizards has, since the very beginning of the game, or at least since after they decided to stop pinning dual lands, decided that basic lands always have to be... nothing can be strictly better than them. There always has to be a reason where, I could play basics and that might be a better option than this land.
Yeah, I know. It is funny, too, when you see cards like Blood Moon that were printed so long ago, but in one of the early expansions. So, there's a very, very, very specific number of years, right, that Magic existed in this place before the designers figured out what was going to work long-term and what wasn't, right? So the first cards come out, and you have the first expansions hitting the shelves in 94. So between 94 and 2000, essentially, is where you have like most of the most unfair things ever and the most like broken, backwards things ever being printed, most specifically in those first couple years. So when you look back, isn't it crazy to see that Blood Moon was printed in like 1994? That was a card that was printed in 94 and is still legal in Modern. It's like that oppressive, and it's a card that was printed a year after the game first came out. Like, of all the mistakes they've made, that's one that for whatever reason they're still standing by.
Well, the format back in that day, it was the swingiest, I would even say. I don't know if I agree that only the most powerful cards came from that time, because Tarmogoyf,
not powerful. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying things they didn't want the game to be able to do.
Oh, sure, like
that's
land destruction.
What I'm saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, the way they designed cards back then was different.
Sure. And part of that is just learning. I mean, it took. Magic is by far the most complex game out there.
Yeah, no question.
And it took them 10 years to figure out, oh, this is the best way to make this game. And then it took them another 10 years to get it like, oh, and this is the best way to make it popular. Like, it took them a while to get even to the level now. And they're still making changes and figuring stuff out. They just changed standard back from the 3-set rotation to a 4-set rotation. So, like, every...
Did we talk about that on the show?
I don't know if we have talked about it on the show. Did you talk about it last week?
I think I might have mentioned it, but I think the announcement came when you were in Hong Kong and I was doing a solo episode, so I don't know if we ever did.
All right, let's put a pin in that. We'll talk about it at the end of the episode.
We'll do it next week. Maybe we're out of time.
Okay, yeah. So that's really kind of the important facets of what you want to do with these lands. I mean, back in the day, dual lands are probably the closest thing to something more powerful than a basic land. And it's kind of why Wasteland has been allowed to survive, I think, in Legacy to a certain extent, is just to kind of be like, here's our encouragement for why these lands aren't going to be too good.
Right.
And I do think one of the reasons they stick with Blood Moon is because they believe that it's not land destruction in the same sense as Armageddon, even though for all intents and purposes it is, but in the sense that it's just more like you still get to tap your lands. They're not in front of you, so it's not as terrible.
Right.
So there's reasoning behind it. I do think, you know, when you're building your mana base, start with fetches and shocks, and I would even say start with 12 fetches and 5 shocks and 5 basics. So that puts you at 22. And then a couple man lands. Start there. And then start kind of whittling down your fetches by adding some spell lands, adding some, you know, if your deck needs to be a little bit, you know, faster, getting rid of the man lands and putting fast lands in there. If you're noticing you have too many spells in the deck that are, you know, competing for how much converted mana cost, so you have, you know, Cryptic Command and Kiki Jiki, then think about maybe throwing a filter land in there. If you're playing, you're like, I can afford a Ghost Quarter or two or three because I need to be able to handle these land decks that are a problem for me, like Jun or like Tron, then, you know, put those in there. Like, it's a slow process to kind of tick down what you need to add, and the fetch lands are kind of where you have that buffer to add and take away lands.
Also remember that when you're dealing with mana base is the one thing that the percentage, the specific percentage, is so dependent on you having a large sample size, so much more than any other card in your deck, because there's 24 to 27 of them in your deck, that make sure when you build a mana base, if you're really trying to perfect it, you slam 30, 40, 50 games before you go to an event, because like that whole idea of like, how often is this happening to me on turn one? How often am I stalling out? How often am I getting ghost quartered and can't recover? Like, you really need to know those things.
Right.
The difference of playing 3 copies of a card in your deck versus playing 4, if it's not something that's just like a slam dunk 4 of, is important. But figuring out your mana base can be so important at the highest level. Like, it's
sure.
It is truly something that requires the biggest sample size more than almost anything else in Magic.
And in front of the cast, Eric Wydatz kind of actually gave me, in my deck building learning past, the best advice I've had for this kind of part of the problem is when you're testing a deck, on the side of somewhere on your phone or anywhere next to the deck name, just keep a running tally. And every time you get mana flooded, put a little +1. add one. Every time you get mana screwed, minus one. And just kind of keep track. And if your number starts, if you start paying attention, you start noticing that the number is starting to get weighted towards, you know, I have 10 points. That means I'm getting flooded too often, or I'm a negative 10. I'm getting mana screwed all the time. Then that's when you start adding, add a land. And then see what happens. Add a land or subtract a land. You know, see where you're going. Or if, oh, I'm getting mana flood every game. Okay, add a man land. Or change, maybe change one of the lands you're playing to a man land, because you're obviously playing too many, so you either should make it a spell or get rid of it. So, you know, there are these little changes you can make to make your deck slightly better and make it so that you're making sure you're hitting your land drops on time. And in the late game, you're not running out of gas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that pretty much wraps us up, no?
Yeah, I think that's it for the episode as far as the land theme. You know, as a reminder, we are at the MMCast on Twitter. I'm at Cass Wiley.
I'm at Ben Bateman Media, and just a reminder once again, guys, that we have moved to collected.company with Jimmy and Josh. We're over there. You can find all of our episodes.
It's the sweetest.
Yeah, it's an awesome. Isn't it a cool brand name, guys? Yeah. Collected.company. Yeah. We just thought it was really cool.
One question, actually, because you brought something up, and I actually am very interested to see how Twitter answers this. So when I started playing Magic and started interacting with Magic on social media, I kind of had a hard, fast rule where I wouldn't really talk about it on Facebook. And you brought up Facebook, so I kind of wanted to ask about this. I want to know from our listeners, do they currently post about Magic on their Facebook page, and or do they how long did it take them to start doing that?
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. That'll be the poll of the week to figure out. So, yeah, that sounds good.
Right. And we'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks for listening. Make sure to let us know how you think about kind of some of the new format that we're trying out. We'd love to hear your feedback.
Yeah, guys, we're always open to changes, and this is a transitional period for us. Where we also want to, just last thing for anybody who's still listening, quick apology just for like sort of the ups and downs of the last month. There's been a lot of kind of inconsistency on the release day, and we've been like jumping around where we've been recording. We're trying to nail down the next little while here and get on the same page. Kessler's been out of town. I've been out of town. It's not something we intend to do for a long time. This is not how things will be. So just letting everybody know, don't panic in case you've been frustrated waiting for it on Wednesday and getting it on Thursday or something like that.
100%. All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye, guys.
Thank you for your attention. See you later, alligator.